We will declare this the meeting of the Legacy Funding Division come to order. Please take your seats if you have done so. Don't quite have a quorum yet. We're taking the approval of the minutes later on when we have a quorum. And so today we will continue with the reports that we have been hearing as to how the legacy funding money was spent by groups in the previous year. We are beginning today by listening to a presentation from the NPR, and we have Lisa Radzik and Jeff Nelson here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Erdahl, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Radzak with Minnesota Public Radio.
And my name is Jeff Nelson, and I'm the Managing Director of Public Strategy at Minnesota Public Radio. First of all, I'm going to ask for your, I'm going to apologize. I'm actually putting my phone out. I have a really pregnant wife. So I'm waiting for the call, and I figured the committee would understand if it was the call. But I don't think it's going to happen right now. I just want to take the opportunity.
I'm saying, let me just for the record say, that's just fine, Mr. Nelson.
Okay. But only that, I understand.
Anything else, no.
Right.
But you may continue.
First of all, I want to thank you for the time that you're taking to ensure that Minnesotans earn a significant return on the investment that they are making through the Legacy Fund. I also understand that we, as Minnesota Public Radio, are very fortunate to be stewards of these funds, and we very much appreciate the fact that you've put us in this role. I'm just going to give you a brief background about Minnesota Public Radio, and then Lisa is going to get into some of the specifics of the investments we've made using legacy funds. As you probably know, through our broadcast signal, Minnesota Public Radio is available for free to well over 95% of Minnesotans, more than 5 million people. Of that, about 900,000, over 900,000 tune in each week to our three regional services, news, classical music, and The Current. Because we cover so much of Minnesota, we are really uniquely positioned to serve as the backbone for Minnesota's emergency alert system, otherwise known as the EAS. Statewide, Minnesota broadcasters really rely on the EAS to provide notice in the event of a local, state, or national emergency. The EAS also supports the Child Abduction Notification Service, or the Amber Alert. Again, we very much appreciate the investment that the taxpayers in the state are making in Minnesota Public Radio, the arts and cultural services that we present, as well as the arts and cultural services of our colleagues at AMPERS and in public television. Now we want to share with you some of the specifics about how NPR is investing the grant it received from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Chairman Erdahl and members, first off, I would just like to relay to you the wonderful work that the folks at the Department of Administration are doing in helping us with walk through this first funding cycle with this grant. They've been very receptive to our questions and really helpful in terms of meeting the deadlines and getting things moving along nicely. So thanks to them and the good work they're doing. At NPR, our overall goal has been to invest our Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund grant in projects that connect more communities and more Minnesotans and families in greater Minnesota to the Minnesota's art history, and cultural heritage in ways that would not have been possible but for the Legacy Amendment. Additionally, because our broadcast signal is available to over 95% of the state, we feel that we have an obligation to really try to connect with greater Minnesota and greater Minnesota communities in ways that perhaps some other organizations wouldn't be able to. The Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund has helped us do just that. For the first year of the legacy funds, we invested $1 million in some of the projects you're about to hear about. And now that the projects are fully up and running and continuing with great progress, we have, in FY11, we're estimating we'll be spending about $1.65 million. And we would like to ask the committee to continue our appropriation at that level, $1.65 million per year for both FY12 and FY13, for a total of $3.3 million for the biennium. As an organization, NPR is very proud of the impact these projects are having around the state. The employees that are working on them are very proud of the ways that it is enabling them to connect with more Minnesotans in more communities, but we would like you to see that for yourself. We're going to play a short video that gives you a quick overview of some of the projects. This video was put together last fall in October, and it is already a little out of date because of the progress these projects are making. So with that, we'd like to show you this video.
From Minnesota Public Radio.
In 2008, Minnesota voters approved passage of the Legacy Amendment, establishing separate funds dedicated to the preservation and support of clean water, wildlife, parks and trails, and arts and culture throughout the state of Minnesota. Thanks to the Legacy Amendment's Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, Minnesota Public Radio has invested in projects that are having an impact throughout Minnesota. Here are some of the NPR projects that the Legacy Amendment's Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund has helped make possible. Rising stars in the classical music world, the Parker Quartet, an internationally renowned string ensemble who calls St. Paul, Minnesota home, became Classical Minnesota Public Radio's first ever artist in residence. In addition to providing performances that were broadcast to Classical NPR's 28 Minnesota stations, the Parker Quartet performed concerts and taught music classes in Winona, Minneapolis, Bemidji, and Duluth.
When the Parker Quartet toured Greater Minnesota, we heard from so many audience members that they were deeply grateful to Minnesota Public Radio for sending the quartet to that town, but especially that we created educational opportunities with the quartet for the kids of that community. The parents were so, so grateful that we had done that.
Partnering with the Minnesota Music Educators Association, Play It Forward was Classical Minnesota Public Radio's first ever musical instrument drive and Minnesota's first ever statewide used instrument drive. Promoted through on-air announcements and live events, Play It Forward collected valuable instruments that were distributed to more than 600 kindergarten to 12th grade kids at more than 300 participating schools throughout Minnesota.
We heard from a lot of teachers who said that it made a big difference in their programs and that they could give some instruments to kids who otherwise wouldn't afford an instrument. It made a big difference for a lot of people, and we're going to do it again.
To provide Minnesota communities with the most up-to-date current events info in cooperation with media organizations throughout the state, Minnesota Public Radio launched Minnesota Today. A new online service, Minnesota Today aims to highlight Minnesota arts, culture, and statewide current events.
My favorite part of Minnesota Today is the collaboration, is the sharing with other news organizations and working in collaboration with them to get important information throughout the state.
Minnesota Today features locally produced news stories from around the state, including summaries of top news from hundreds of Minnesota information sources monitored by NPR news editors. A statewide arts and cultural events calendar featuring extensive listings of concerts, plays, art exhibits, festivals, and other activities taking place in local communities. Minnesota Scenes, a showplace of Minnesota photography. Minnesota Sounds captures iconic sounds from communities across the state. And audio archives from the NPR Audio Vault highlight our shared history and cultural heritage.
Present the dedication concert in Orchestra Hall.
Elsewhere from NPR News, you'll find State of the Arts, a blog that highlights Minnesota's vibrant arts and cultural scene.
We try and cover the breadth and depth of the amazing creativity and ideas that are out there in the state, from poetry to dance and theater, architecture and design, music, film. We try and give all of it its due time and really emphasize just how rich this state is when it comes to creativity and the arts.
Similarly, Art Hounds is a weekly online and on-air production that asks people from the Minnesota arts scene to step outside their own work, hunt down something exciting that's going on in local arts, and share it with the rest of us.
Art Hounds provides a really unique glimpse of the Minnesota arts landscape through the people that know it best, the actors, the artistic directors, the performers, the musicians. We've gone into every nook and cranny of the Minnesota art scene, and we're really proud of that.
The Current from Minnesota Public Radio is a service that brings listeners the best authentic new music alongside the music that inspired it. From local to legendary, indie to influential, new to nostalgic.
There's so much great music that comes out of Minnesota. Last year on The Current, we played over 450 local artists, over 11,000 times on the air, and the Legacy Amendment has enabled us to expand our reach into areas of Minnesota where you couldn't hear The Current previously.
Additionally, The Current launched a new Sunday night series called The Current Presents, a radio experiment that brings new sounds, new voices, and new programs to the airwaves every Sunday night at 9 p.m.
We've had a chance to explore a lot of different ideas that normally don't have like a space in radio for, but this is an opportunity for us to really try something different.
In addition to its on-air and online offerings, Minnesota Public Radio produces live events that entertain and engage audiences at the Fitzgerald Theater. One series of productions is called Wits, co-hosted by NPR's John Moe and Minnesota musician John Monson.
With the Wits series, we talked to some nationally known writers, we brought in some musicians from all over the place, and we just had a good old-fashioned Minnesota get-together. We talked about family, we talked about work, we talked about staying focused. I think we laughed a lot, certainly, and we learned a lot, too.
Videos of Fitzgerald Theater shows are made available online so that as many people as possible have access to the programs.
Our stage, radio, and digital audiences are coming to life on a regular basis, and they expect it now. And at first, you would think that the stage was the point of what we were making, but it really has become Minnesota Public Radio's largest broadcast studio.
All of us at Minnesota Public Radio are grateful to the Legacy Amendment for allowing us to further our impact and extend our reach to more Minnesota communities. Minnesotans entrusting us with these precious dollars is something we take very seriously, and we are committed to continuing this work to serve the people of Minnesota.
Something that you're going to hear a lot from us is the word impact. And reaching, you know, over 900,000 Minnesotans a week is one of the ways that we really see NPR acting as a megaphone for arts and culture in this state, where we can take Minnesota artists and take something that might only reach a handful of people or a few hundred people and get that out to an audience of tens or hundreds of thousands. One of those programs is Art Hounds, which was mentioned in the video, but we want to give you a little more of a taste of what Art Hounds is. What we actually have done is we've created a program that is about the arts by artists. So we invite three Minnesota artists to talk briefly about a performance that they're excited about, not something they've done, something they are excited about outside of their work in the community. And it's a really great way for folks to get some insight, not only into what an artist is like, but what the artist's like. And we would actually like to play a clip for you that gives you a sense of what this sounds like.
And now, in Inside, look at the Minnesota art scene from the people who know it best. Introducing this week's Art Hounds.
I'm Eric Brandt, local songwriter and coordinator of the International Baccalaureate Program at Harding High School on the east side of St. Paul.
Yona Poki Vanok.
That was my daughter Eloise, wishing a good day to you in Hungarian. And she's not here to show off her linguistic chops. We are here to tell you about an upcoming Tanzhaus, a Hungarian folk dance house featuring the Saska Band. Saska will be playing at an event sponsored by the Minnesota Hungarians on January 15th at Unity Unitarian Church, 736 Holly Avenue in St. Paul, with a 4:30 workshop to learn the dance, 5:30 dancing for children, and dancing for everybody from 6 to 11. My family and I had the privilege of living in Budapest, Hungary for a year, and we often would go to Hungarian folk dances. So when we returned to Minnesota, the Minnesota Hungarian dance houses were a great way for us to reconnect with that experience. The band will be great, they always are, but what's really special is everyone coming together and learning these dances and the whole community, children dancing with grandparents, and new people who have never been there before, just joining in the fun.
See you, Stuck!
Oh, and that's Hungarian for goodbye.
There is a new art gallery in downtown St. Cloud. It's called the Gallery Vault, and it is worth checking out. I'm Shar Hopala, and I am a visual artist from St. Cloud. The Gallery Vault is run by students at St. Cloud State University. Lots of edgy student art, unlike what you are going to see elsewhere in St. Cloud. The Gallery Vault makes a difference to the downtown area. It makes a difference to have storefronts that are alive with light and artwork and young people, rather than a stretch of dirty windows and darkness. These students are saying to themselves, hey, this is an opportunity to show my work to St. Cloud, whether or not someone looks at it and in the end writes a check. And so I think that results in a different taste and experimentation, and it makes for an exciting place.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, been snooping around the door.
Martin Luther King Day is coming up, and anyone who is interested in history or loves great music of the late 50s needs to come to this show, Rondo 56, Remembering St. Paul's African American Main Street. I'm Maria Jetty. I'm a singer in the Twin Cities.
You told me you was hiding but I can see through that.
Ironically, I drove to NPR today on Highway 94, and Highway 94 is the reason for this program, because Highway 94 obliterated the Rondo neighborhood. So Rondo 56 will be performed at St. Joan of Arc Church in South Minneapolis on January the 16th at 7 p.m. Dan Chouinard put this show together in collaboration with the Minnesota Historical Society, so he was able to utilize a lot of their photographic evidence from the late 50s about that great neighborhood.
You women have heard of jalopies, you heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88.
He will mix these photographs with tidbits of the history to imagine what that neighborhood was like in St. Paul before we all started to drive through it. Besides a really fantastic band, we've got some really great singers. Yolanda Bruce, Cynthia Johnson, Thomasina Petrus, and then Bruce Henry and T. Michael Rambo. Plus, the St. Joan of Arc Choir. So this is really going to be a musical extravaganza.
Heading for the station with a pack on my back. I'm tired of transportation in the back of a hack. I love to hear the rhythm of the clickety-clack and hear the lonesome whistle, see the smoke from the stack. And pal around with Democratic fellas named Mac. So take me right back to the track.
So again, one of the great opportunities of radio is that a lot of the performances and exhibits that you heard about on Art Hounds would have a difficult time getting the word out to people throughout Minnesota. Because of this, 40,000 people heard that. And so, again, this is a great way to inform Minnesotans about the great artwork that's going on all around them. In you have the packet in front of you, there's a letter from the proprietors of a New London art gallery called Art House. They were featured on Art Hounds, and they've noted the fact that they've seen a significant uptick in visitors since that since they were featured. And so, as you can tell, they were very appreciative of what we've done with Art House.
Behind that document in the packet, Mr. Chair, members, behind the document in the packet Jeff just referenced, there's a piece of paper labeled Play It Forward. Play It Forward is another one of our projects, and working with the Minnesota Music Educators Association, Classical NPR created a statewide instrument drive to bring more instruments into the hands of students, Minnesota students who couldn't otherwise afford to participate in band or orchestra. In 2010, through the generous donations of hundreds of Minnesotans, K through 12 schools throughout Minnesota were able to take in instruments and allow more than 600 students to participate in their school's music program. One of the quotes on that sheet that I gave you towards the bottom, the music teacher in Hopkins said, "We had a little girl that moved into Hopkins. She really wanted to play the flute, and I didn't have one for her. And that night there was a voicemail with someone saying, I have a flute to donate. I dropped it off to the little girl the next day, and she was just in tears." So needless to say, we look forward to this year's drive, the 2011 drive. The dates are set for May 2nd through May 30th. And this year we'll be having a second drive September 12th through October 14th. Make sure you all get that information so you can pass it along to your schools if you're interested in forwarding it to them.
And we have one final exhibit that we'd like to show you before we answer any of your questions, and that's to talk about the Minnesota Audio Archive. When the state decided to make an investment in NPR, one of the things that we heard loud and clear from you was the importance of Minnesota's history and the fact that, that we have over 40 years of history in audio form currently locked up in a vault in our basement and inaccessible to the public, and in many cases on tape that has a shelf life that's rotting and will eventually be lost. And so thanks to the investment you made through legacy funds, we have started the process, it's a daunting process, to digitize, again, those 40 years of Minnesota's history. And we just want to play you an example of some of what we have digitized so far.
Minnesota Public Radio, covering Minnesota since 1967. In 1990, Soviet President and General Secretary of the Communist Party, Mikhail Gorbachev, spoke to business leaders in Minneapolis.
Well, I was told that your state is a closed state, but right now it's beginning to open toward the Soviet Union, that is to say, your arch enemy.
Как все быстро меняется.
See how fast things are changing.
Хорошо, что так меняется.
It's very good that they are changing.
In 1975, Minnesota farmers were facing potential upheaval.
Mr. Swanson, do you have any indication of how serious an economic impact it would be in terms of dollars if palm oil became a widespread substitute for soybean oil?
It could be devastating. Soybeans are currently, our, for the upper Midwest at least, and especially Minnesota, soybeans are our second most important cash farm crop, second only to corn.
Robert Swanson of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
And this gentleman needs no introduction.
Well, now it's 1998, and the American dream lives on in Minnesota as we shock the world.
I may have to apologize to some of you.
Minnesota Public.
Sorry.
These are just a few examples of what will be available on the archive for all Minnesotans.
Ms. Radzik, you don't have any legislator speeches on there, do you?
No.
I don't want some of my words.
Cheeseburgers?
Back. Yeah, well, I was thinking about that one.
But these are just a few examples, and we're, we welcome any questions that the committee has. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Radzik and Mr. Nelson. Just one question for myself to kind of kick it off a little bit. What percentage of your funds comes from the taxpayers? You know that?
Absolutely.
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, overall, the between state and federal funding, around 7% of our revenue comes from the government. 2%, actually less than 2% of that comes from the state between our general appropriation for equipment in Greater Minnesota and legacy fund.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Also, the sheet here that in the examples that you had with your various legacy fund investments in this last year, you know, Played Forward and Art Hounds. And by the way, you were aware of this Art Hound endorsement letter that I taught in New London for 35 years? You weren't trying to influence anything with that, were you?
Mr. Chair, we're always trying to influence things.
Do you have a breakdown about how much legacy funding was spent in each of these areas?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. We have a rather extensive spreadsheet with a whole bunch of worksheets that I'd be happy to provide. Just not sure how much or how little you want to kind of have available.
Well, thank you, Ms. Radzik. Too much information tends to confuse us sometimes, but if you could tell us in each of these categories how much money went into each, that would be helpful, I think.
Absolutely.
And if some members wanted more information, we would ask for that, but at least that to start.
I'll make sure to get it to you and the committee administrator.
Thank you. Members' questions. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions were about the budget as well. Did you say 2% was from taxpayer funding? So is that what I understood?
Mr. Nelson.
Representative Pepin, Mr. Chair, yeah, from the state of Minnesota, between legacy funding and our general appropriation, it's less than 2% of our revenue to Minnesota Public Radio.
Okay, I guess if you could provide what the budget is with the revenue, and then what the, including the dollar amounts, because I'm not I can't remember what the general fund appropriation is. Maybe you have an estimate.
Oh, absolutely. We receive, and I'll, Mr. Chair, Lisa may correct me. $230,000. I've been in Washington, D.C. a little too much recently. $230,000 is our general appropriation, which we use only for equipment in greater Minnesota to help build stations in areas of the state that wouldn't be reached without that appropriation. And then our legacy appropriation for this most recent fiscal year was $1.65 million. If you look at our total revenue for Minnesota Public Radio, it's in the neighborhood of $76 million.
For Minnesota?
For Minnesota. And that's Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media. So it includes our regional programming, but they are one entity. So it includes our regional programming and our national portfolio.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So $76 million, then, is 2% of your... your entire revenue?
76.
Mr. Nelson.
$76 million is our total revenue to Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media. From the state government, it's $1.65 million and $230,000.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Pepin.
I'm curious if you could talk about, since you are getting taxpayer funding, I think this is a fair question, what the salaries are to the top executives at NPR. If you could talk about that a little bit.
Representative Pepin, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, members of the committee, in the happy to provide the specifics for individuals, we currently report not just the compensation of our employees, but the benefits package, all the kind of all the information you want to know about a given employee to the Attorney General's office annually, as well as to the IRS in our 990 form. But I'd be happy to get you a copy of all those reporting documents.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. That would be great. I'm wondering, just for the purposes of today, though, if you could maybe, if you would know off the top of your head, maybe the top two salaries, would they be in the neighborhood of maybe $500,000 a year, or...
I'm sorry, I don't know those off the top of my head. Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm sorry. Off the top of my head, Representative Pepin, I don't know those.
Representative Pepin?
Okay. Well, my recollection is from Representative Seifert when he was there was that was around the ballpark. Do you know about what percentage of your budget goes towards salaries? Any chance?
Ms. Radzik. Mr. Nelson.
Representative Pepin, Mr. Chair. We can get you very specific figures even today. So I will say that a significant portion of our budget goes to salaries just because as an industry, the majority of what we do requires people. So if you just look at broadcasting as an industry, certainly the capital costs for transmitters and electricity and all of that are significant, but really the most significant cost to Minnesota Public Radio for what we do regionally is people to produce the programs, to interview, to be the engineer. So as a percentage of our budget, you'll see that it is significant.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, and I'll look forward to getting that information. Just on the legacy fund part, the sheet you did provide, and you have on that part you have the salaries and benefits. I was just wondering about how many. It's 1.1 million. About how many staff people the money has allowed NPR to hire in addition to the other staff?
Ms. Radzik.
Mr. Chair, members, I know that last count, 83 employees have been working on the projects. The breakdown of full-time FTEs, I need to check for you, but I know that it's a significant number of employees that are very involved in the projects that we've mentioned today.
I will say that NPR will be back to present to us again with their requests for the next funding cycle here. And if we haven't received these before, some of these answers to some of these questions, we would expect that you have them by that time.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, just following up on that, one of the goals that we had when we appropriated funding or recommended appropriations for funding was jobs. And so I would like a breakdown if there were new jobs and they're and if they're permanent jobs that were established with the money that you received.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'd be happy to provide that.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I looked it up. For Minnesota Public Radio, 54% of our total expenses go to personnel. Roughly $39.2 million is the total personnel cost, and that's our budget for FY11.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? And thank you. We'll see you again. Next, we will hear from the Indian Affairs Council and Jolyn Shaptes and Anna Marie Hill. Welcome to the committee, ladies.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Erdahl and members of the committee. My name is Anna Marie Hill Kleinhans, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council.
My name is Jolyn Shaptes. I'm the Legislative and Grants Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council.
I know I'm not stated on the agenda, but I did want to come as sort of to talk a little bit about the legacy funding money that we have in the Indian Affairs Council as sort of a prelude, an introduction to Jolyn Shaptes, who will launch into the programs that we're doing and the things that we're doing at in a more in-depth level. First of all, I want to say that the total amount of funding that we receive during the last biennium was $1.9 million, and that money was dedicated entirely for something that is entirely new and entirely different in the state of Minnesota and to the Indian Affairs Council, and it is called Indian Language Preservation. So the efforts are to revitalize two very different languages, two very distinct languages from two very different American Indian culture and language groups, which are the Dakota and Ojibwe languages. These languages are what we refer to as endangered languages, which means that they are almost entirely extinct and lost forever. So although we're here to speak about the Indian language preservation programs that we have, I just want to mention that we also have an initiative right now with the Minnesota Humanities Center, and we received money also that is with the Minnesota Humanities Center for arts and culture programs there, and I want to thank you for that as well. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Jolyn Shaptes, who is going to give you a broader overview of what we are doing the money, and I'll remain here for any questions that you might have at the end of the testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Shaptes.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl. I'm just going to walk you through the document you have in front of you. A little bit of background about the Indian Affairs Council. We are a state agency. We were created in 1963, and we are a liaison between the state of Minnesota and the 11 tribal governments within the state. We were the second such agency that was created in the United States. And after that, there are many other states that have created a similar department in the state to address similar issues. The council provides a forum and advises state government on issues of concern to the American Indian community of Minnesota. We play a central role in the development of state legislation by monitoring programs that affect the state's American Indian population and tribal governments. We are made up of our board as the 11 tribal chairs of Minnesota or their designees. Also seated on our board is the Commissioner of Education, Commissioner of Human Services, a member of the Governor's staff, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, Human Rights, Employee and Economic Development, Corrections, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Iron Rain Resource and Rehabilitations, the Department of Health, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Administration, or their designees. Below is our mission and vision statement, and the brochure that you've also been provided goes a little bit more in depth about more information on our department. We were appropriated, as Anna Marie Hill said, we were appropriated $1.9 million. $150,000 was appropriated to conduct a volunteer working group feasibility study on Dakota and Ojibwe languages in Minnesota. $550,000 in 2010 and $750,000 in 2011 to issue grants for programs to preserve Dakota and Ojibwe language and to foster educational programs in Dakota and Ojibwe languages. We also had a $250,000 pass-through to two of the state's only immersion schools, and that is the Bugganegishit School up on the Leech Lake Reservation, and then Wachoye, and I don't speak Dakota, so I will have them give you the appropriate pronunciation of their words, as well as the meaning behind their name. And we had a pass-through to those two schools, and one of those schools is here, and we'll present to you a little bit more about what was done with that money.
Thank you.
I do want to, again, thank this committee for their support in the past, and we hope that we will see continued support from this committee. I just want to go over some of the things that have been happening with the Volunteer Feasibility Working Group. The first thing we did was create a mission and a value statement, and those are before you. Our mission was that Dakota and Ojibwe are spoken and valued as vibrant, living, and thriving languages throughout Minnesota. The value statement was to protect and empower our children, parents, and elders in the continuing development of our language, thus maintaining tribal sovereignty. This group has been meeting since August 2009. We've been meeting every month for at least one day, if not 2 days. This was a huge task to undertake, and we were very lucky to have people seated on this committee that are completely dedicated to the revitalization of our indigenous languages in Minnesota, of Dakota and Ojibwe. They have spent hours and hours and hours traveling to meetings, sitting through meetings, and going through stacks of information. And this is not something that any of them take lightheartedly. This is very important to our state and to our tribes. And I just want to, you know, thank them publicly for all of their hard work. We were given 10 tasks that we needed to go through, and I won't read them. They're in front of you. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with them. And this feasibility study will be reported to the legislature on February 15th. So we are very close to being done. We are very excited about what we are learning, and we will be sharing that with you guys later, so I won't get too much into that. And I've just kind of said a little bit more in here about what we've done, the surveys we've conducted, and the people that we've talked to. The other program that we've been doing is our Dakota and Ojibwe Language Revitalization Grants. As I mentioned, we granted out $550,000 to Dakota and Ojibwe Language Revitalization, and that was for fiscal year 2010, and for 2011, $700,000. To create a grant advisory committee, to create an RFP, to distribute the RFP, to get the RFPs back in, to review them, to agree on who should be funded, to write the contract in a state department in less than a year was a huge task. And we undertook it with the gumption that we will get this done, we will get this done on time, and I did promise the committee we would get it done on time, and we did. We were right at the last minute, but we got everything done. There were 15 grants that came in for funding, and their total was $1,197,597. And we only had $550,000 to grant out. But I think that just shows to our department and to the state that this is a huge undertaking that needs to be done. And there are people out there ready and willing and have the ideas to take a stance in revitalizing our languages. If we could have granted out much more money, we would have, but we simply didn't have the funds. One thing that we kept coming to was that this was a new thing for our office. This is something we have never done before, and granting out over $1 million is a huge undertaking. We wanted to make sure that we were transparent. We wanted to make sure that there was no conflict of interest. So we consulted very heavily with the state's Office of Grant Management, and I see that they're here, and so I want to say thank you for all of your help. We also followed the state's conflict of interest policy, and we also consulted heavily with other grant-making entities to learn about how they came about with other grant processes, what's the best way to do it, and we did not want to reinvent the wheel if we didn't have to. When it came to finding the people to review the grants, we wanted to avoid conflict as much as possible, conflict of interest, so we tried to we found people who were either from Wisconsin, or if they were from Minnesota, they were either not from a Minnesota tribe that was applying for grants, or they had nothing to do with any of the organizations that were applying. We also tried really hard to either find people who were language experts or had a lot of grant-making decisions in their background. Because this was so new to us, we really wanted to rely on people that had a lot of experience. We did use the same people on the feasibility study report group as the grant-making group. And the reason why we did this is because there's not a whole bunch of people out there right now that have the knowledge about our languages. So we just utilized the same people. And we did have the meetings for the grant were in the morning, and then the meetings for the feasibility report were in the afternoon, or vice versa. So they were all at the same time, so there was no extra money incurred. And then the last page just goes over all the grants that were made. It just gives a little bit of a summary about what the grants were and the progress that is being made right now.
Thank you very much. Some questions in just a moment, but first, Representative Green, are you feeling a strong urge to move the minutes of February 1st? The approval of the minutes of February 1st has been moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Green. Now, questions? Anyone on the report thus far? I know when you made this request a year ago, you had some concern about administrative cost, and just wondering how you felt that worked out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we didn't receive any portion of this didn't go to any administration costs. So that was left out of the initial writing of the language. We took what we had and we set forward in our best efforts to make it work because it was a very important. I myself am not a linguist and I'm not a language expert. So a lot of what I had learned at that time was brand new to me. But I did know that so many people were passionate about revitalizing these two languages. So we took what we had, and we remained as positive as we could. With the small staff composition that we have, which are only five people, and I dumped it all on her. So not entirely. We went at it together. And we do have so many good friends who came to the forefront and helped us out, including the state of Minnesota's grant management department and the Department of Administration. They're always there to answer the questions and tell you how to do exactly the right thing with regards to contracts and granting money. Bear in mind, we had never granted out money before, and I had almost no experience in granting. She had a little. I think we've taken on a very big project, and we've done a good job at it. And if the question is, would we like administration money the next time, the answer is yes. So that will help. However, we are willing and able to do this language preservation effort. Let me tell you one of the things I didn't tell you, which is a little postlude to what she said, is my understanding that language preservation throughout the world has been undertaken successfully very few times. The noted languages that have been revitalized are the Celtic language, the Maori language, and the Hawaiian languages. Now, there are probably more, but many have failed. We're talking about revitalizing lost, near-lost languages. This is a huge deal. And people are watching us statewide and nationally. We've been on a national radio talking about this, and internationally. This is a big deal that we're doing together. So how's that for a short answer?
Well, thank you very much. Ms. Hill, do you? How many native speakers are there identified in each Dakota and Ojibwe?
I think we go back and forth with that all the time. I remember clearly that when I started working on this, there were somewhere around 15. Okay, so and now she's talking that, and those are speakers who are 70 and on up. So I'm relying.
How many would you?
8 left in the Dakota community in Minnesota that we are aware of. So many have died since we started these efforts.
8
okay?
Dakota.
8 left in the Minnesota.
How about Ojibwe?
Ojibwe, I think that what was that?
300,
and that's in Minnesota.
Okay, I know that there are different linguistic dialects that Lakota, Nakota, Dakota are all dependent upon the various alphabetic pronunciations. Which of those are we talking about here?
We're talking about Dakota here in Minnesota. That's the language we're revitalizing here in Minnesota, the Dakota language.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I just am excited to receive your enthusiasm. It was an enormous task that we set out, but you agreed to it, and you begged for it. And I'm very anxious to see the report in February, but I just have to commend you for your persistence and your enthusiasm. And I remember the figures 15 and 8 that were given to us, and I was hoping that through your meetings and receiving new information and so forth, that new people would be exposed or somebody would come, people would know of someone else that we could touch. Because that 8, if we're down to 8 and people have died, they will at that age, I thought, well, maybe someone else will come forth. Did that happen at all?
Ms. Hill.
Did we get new names?
Representative Murphy, members of the committee, I think the names are the ones that we had at the upfront and that we gathered. There are always individuals, I believe, that are first language speakers, such as my father, who are out there and who aren't necessarily accounted for because he's not at the political forefront of things. So he's just at home doing his own thing. And he, however, is a first language speaker, and so perhaps we haven't counted him or relied on him as heavily. But there are also a lot of personal decisions with not speaking the language. As you know, you've heard about many of the different reasons why a language first language speaker will not come forward or will not speak their language. We have continually remained counting. So that's something that we have continued to do throughout this entire process. We've continued to be open to different counts that have been presented to us, whether it's from a university, whether someone in Canada has a different count, because there are Ojibwe speakers up there. We're divided by the international border. So we have continually counted. And so the count has changed, but it's remained around the same. So that's where we can come to the conclusion that we have. We also, I think, in presenting this feasibility study and report, a lot of the information will be like that. We came to this conclusion But this is such a difficult and complicated undertaking that we're looking at that today this is the best work. Does that make sense? So, yeah, that's what we have done. And we debate that every time. How many are we sure? So.
But if we can, Mr. Chair, it would
Representative
seem
Murphy.
To me that if we keep the list alive and growing a little bit, then we won't have to do it 10 years from now
right.
again.
I think one of the things that obviously we... Mr. Chair, sorry. Representative Murphy, I think one of the things that we won't be able to do is keep alive the first speakers. So that that has an end date on it. But what we're trying to do is revitalize the language in the best way that we come to. We also will not be able to have a completely integrated immersion setting, from my understanding, but something that's referred to as a simulated immersion setting, whereas you have second language speakers or those who have learned to speak the language fluently but can never enter back into the immersion setting or into our own, into the country where the language is flourishing and spoken. We just can't go somewhere and get there. So we're doing so much to... Actually, we're starting a new list, aren't we? Because if we revitalize this language, we're going to start with those kids. And although it will always be in question whether or not it is the true and authentic, it will be a good, thriving language that we have. And we will revitalize that. And again, we'll start that new list and we'll just grow it. And so we'll have a whole different body of speakers and a flourishing community that will be present at the time when we complete this task, which may be about 20 years from now. So 10, it takes a long time.
Mr. Chair, then one final point then. And do you see that the public broadcasting, the radio, and the TV funding that has been presented for possible legacy funding, that could be of assistance to you?
Ms. Hill.
Representative Erdahl, Representative Murphy, yes, I do believe there are a world of opportunities with regards to partnership. Particularly, I'm a big one with when it comes to media or getting as many people on board as possible, and I see some of the greatest and worst work can be done on behalf of or to us through the media, because that's where you're really going to get the attention. I don't think we've gotten there by any means, because we have not had the ability. I believe we've talked on this. It's been some time and my memory gets slight, but I believe we've talked on these efforts and the money that was appropriated to us on a national web show, Native America Calling. So we had our leaders go on and speak about that, and that is when it became known throughout Indian country and the world what we were doing, and with the Smithsonian Institute, and then the eyes went on us. And they're still on us. They're excited. They're waiting for this to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about the project. This is, I guess, a question that's completely grounded in ignorance, but is recapturing exclusively oral, or is there a written component that can be used, and how does that work? I mean, presumably the language wasn't developed originally as a written language. It was I would assume oral, but I don't know, and I'm curious to know how you put those together.
Ms. Hill.
Chair Erdahl and Representative, that's a very, very good question, and it is not an ignorant one. The languages were oral languages, so they were not written languages. Now we have both of the languages being written, and I think studies and writings and interpretation of the language in a written context are happening all the time, and there are various ways of writing them down. However, they've been written for some time, because if you look at the genealogy of any one of us, such as if I look back at the genealogy of my grandfather or even my great-great-grandfather, he had a written name. Now, I could see that name many different ways, but I could still look at it and see that it was. So it's been written down for some time. The history that precedes writing it down is an oral history. Does this pose different viewpoints on whether or not you should revitalize it, write it down? Yes, it does. People have different opinions about this. However, what we are doing is we are, in fact, today working on the written language as well as the spoken language, which are both in and of themselves lost. So the written language being a fairly new. Does that help answer the question?
It does. And Mr. Chair, if I could just ask a follow-up.
Representative Winkler.
So I guess I see there are two kind of paths I could see here. One would be to try to establish an official, authentic record, or to capture historic authenticity in some way to so that it's captured for future generations to see and observe. Another purpose could be to reintroduce it, have people use it, have it change, evolve, and have it be more of a living, vital language, mm-hmm. which might, over time, dramatically depart from, you know, what was even before it was written down. How do you balance those, or what's your direction?
Ms. Hill.
Chair Erdahl, Representative Winkler. I'm not sure if you can come to some sort of even balance with regards to those two challenges, but in the feasibility study, we answer questions about what are we going to do, what does a curriculum look like, having a uniform curriculum, as well as how are we going to speak this. And I think the dialects come into play when you're discussing how to revitalize a language such as the Ojibwe language, too, and know that there are several different dialects or ways of speaking. I think we're approaching all those thoughts and the complexity of what's going into revitalizing this language. It's very, very complex, as you can probably gather just from listening. And we're trying to somehow merge those in so they'll partner together as we move forward. Perhaps we're going to come up with a best curriculum or one sort of curriculum. Perhaps we're going to have one dictionary that we use and not 10 along the way. But I at this time, I can safely say that it's in the beginning processes, and I'm not sure how we're going to get to that conclusion. However, we do have the luxury today of you do have the luxury today of hearing from people who are working specifically in these areas that have for a long time and are second language speakers. And I'm not sure if we have a first language speaker with us today. However, they can more readily perhaps explain some of the parallel work that is going on with all of these different thoughts and how to. So, again, I think that we're not looking at something that's going to be concrete and leading us down here, but it's such an initiative that there are so many things that are going to go into it. I think one of the most unique one is how do you revitalize oral languages and get to where we are today. So, mm-hmm.
Thank you. Hey, thank you. And just that, you know, time-wise here, I think this portion probably should draw to a close. By a quarter to, I want to start with the libraries. Just one comment and then one final quick question from me, and that is I believe that the written Dakota language started with Reverend Stephen Riggs developing it in the mid-1840s, about that time. So just a little historical perspective on that today. And also, your grants, if you could, when you come the next time or sometime in between, would you let us know how much was given to each of the grant recipients, please?
Mr. Chair, I have that information if you would like it now or at another time, whatever you prefer.
I think it's best if you email it to Ms. Beach, and then we will distribute it to the members. Okay, so thank you, and we'll bring on, you know, this is not a Norwegian name that we have here, so I'm not going to try to pronounce it. You'll have to come on up and introduce yourself. Welcome, ladies. Appreciate you coming here today. I'm sorry we only have about 10 minutes for your presentation, so appreciate being as timely as you can. Would you identify yourselves, please, for the record?
I'm Margaret Boyer, and I'm the outgoing executive director of the Wachoye Nandikikanden Urban Immersion Project.
See, Margaret Boyer, I could say.
Chairman Erdahl and committee members, my name is Jennifer Bendixson, and I also work with the Wachoye Project. I'm a parent coordinator and one of the, Margaret likes to call me one of the founding member mothers.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Kimberly Bolio. I am a parent of children involved in the program, and I'm also a parent engagement coordinator for the Ojibwe.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Lori Harper, and I am the incoming director for Wachoye Nandikikanden.
Would you pronounce the Urban Immersion Project's name one more time for me?
Wachoye Nandikikanden.
That's what I thought.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Wachoye is a Dakota word. It means letters and words, and Nandikikanden means learning.
Thank you.
And it has Dakota and Ojibwe immersion. We have four classrooms. We're serving 60 children. We have two classrooms at Anishinaabe Academy in Dakota with 20 children, Ojibwe with 20 children. And then we have two other sites where we begin serving children that are only 16 months up to five. And in those classes each, we have up to 10 to 14 children. And as the younger you are, the easier it is to learn the language. They hear one word and they know it. We wanted to talk about two aspects of language revitalization, and I was going to just talk about academic achievement, its impact, and Lori is going to talk about the culture and regaining a sense of self, and some other comments. I just wanted to say, in Minneapolis, to become kindergarten ready, you need to have at least a score of 80. And we have children coming on out of our program that are scoring 160. And we even some of the special needs kids in our program have been scoring 100. One of our little girl had been in it from when she was 16 months, was scored off the charts. Recently, a few months ago, the U of M did a research study on the math skills in our Dakota immersion classroom, and they were over three times higher than the control group. And because a lot of math concepts are built into the words of the language, the children... when we first started, we begged the Minneapolis Public Schools to let us come in and be involved with 3 hours of immersion a day, one for Dakota and one for Ojibwe. And the principal at Anishinaabe was willing to take the risk, and we did that, and they now are fully committed to the program because they see the incredible academic achievement impact that it's having on the kids. And we have an image of a four-year-old girl reading a book in Dakota we wanted to show you. I just wanted to say we brought some other people with us. Sheldon Knoll and Olga Wastaste are from Sioux Valley, Manitoba. They're fluent Dakota speakers. Olga is a first language speaker. Sheldon was raised by his great-grandmother and speaks Dakota. And their families lived here over 150 years ago, so they're coming back home to help us with the language, since there's... And I also wanted to point out that Barbara Honska from St. Cloud, who has rheumatoid arthritis, gets on a bus every week and comes down and works in our program for 2 days. She's one of the last of the 8 Dakota speakers. She's so committed to being willing to pass it on. And Betty Jane Schaaf there with is our curriculum specialist, who's making sure that we had to create all our own curriculum, that we're meeting all the state standards, the Minneapolis standards, all the learning domains and indicators of progress. We're meeting all those in our curriculum. So, do you want to...
Mr. Chair and committee members, what I'd like to add in, you heard a little about the language revitalization efforts on Dakota and Ojibwe language from the previous presenters, and something that I wanted to add that is never stressed enough is that this is the homeland of Dakota and Ojibwe language. We cannot go anywhere else to learn our languages. This is where it is. This is who we are. This is where we're from. This is where we need to be revitalizing our languages. And the other thing I wanted to point out, within the realm of early childhood education and language revitalization, we're always in need of educators who can teach in our language and represent us, our faces, our skin in those classrooms, because if our students don't see us in those classrooms, they certainly don't see themselves. And so what we're showing in just a little bit of what our funding has been able to provide is that firmer knowledge of knowing themselves. Our impact is not just with early childhood. It's within our community. Our family members are taking it upon themselves to learn more of our languages, to want to know what their children are saying, to want to create that community of language. The studies that have been done on second language acquisition are not very recent. I believe that they're 30 and 35 years old, and that's not native language second language acquisition. Those are done on foreign language acquisition. But taking that and building upon the brain development of children and reintroducing our languages to our children has really provided a better understanding of ourselves and our place in this world.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for hearing our story today. I just wanted to add a little bit about the parent side of it. I have 2 children, and they were both enrolled in the program last year. They're both 5 years old, and our daughter, Nevaeh, we finalized her adoption in 2009. And she came to our home from the foster care system. She was very scared, didn't have any sense of cultural identity, didn't really know who she was. She was a victim of neglect and abuse. And just learning the language in school and bringing that home, she was just so proud to be able to speak those words, and she was surprised that I knew some words, and it helped our bond and gave her a sense of identity and community. And since then, she's been excelling socially. She used to be so timid. She wouldn't talk to strangers. Now we bring her to the office, and she just runs around and talks to people. And at our language nest, she's talking everywhere. And she's just excelled so much, and it's helped her heal. It's been medicine for her. And my son, they're both in kindergarten right now, and I just got his report card. And actually, at the beginning of the year, during the school conferences, he is advanced in his reading and math. And I don't know if anybody is familiar with the grade reporting system at the public schools, but he scored 4 in 3 areas in reading and 4 in 3 areas in math. So it's just been outstanding for him academically and her socially. And just with this, we do language nests every Thursday. We do some language work with the parents, and we do a moccasin group. We started that last week. And since that started, the kids just, they start forming these new friendships, and the parents start forming friendships with each other. And it's just the start of it, and we're just looking forward to continuing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bolio.
Chairman Erdahl and committee members,
Ms. Bendixson.
I'd like to say Damakota, Minnesota did what he, Minnesota was the Chidake. I said that I'm a Dakota person and that Minnesota is my home and that I love Minnesota. This is the language that belongs here. We met one time in a meeting with a man who said, the land is hungry again to hear for the language of the Dakota people speaking it. So with your support and help, I know that that language will come back.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just some of your money we put in front of you. We have over 100 children's books now written in Dakota and Ojibwe, and we gave you some examples, and there's also a parent newsletter. But we have a little video of a 4-year-old reading a book in Dakota we'd like to show you.
Makapsi chazi daku wadaka he shukawakato daku wadaka he nashka peji kawabada. Nashka pelito. Daku wadaka he. Ihmusta wabadake. Daku wadaka he. Shukaska daku wadaka he. Cha wandia pisapa wapada. Tacha wandia pisapa daku wadaka he. Kohan shazi daku wadaka he. What else?
Hashem got the child lead. She called a cartoon. Now she got the little. She was star. She called a superstar. We need to suffer over the leaf. What was the champion?
Thank you. Those are very impressive, and because of the big pictures, a lot of us could understand. Yeah. Does she? Can she read English as well?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the kindergarten readiness tests are all given in English, so they're excelling. Even though they don't hear English in our classes, they're excelling in English over their counterparts who only hear English.
Okay. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you coming here today. We need to get the... Did you have a burning question, Representative Winkler, or not?
Chair,
you want to ask a question?
Chair,
it's okay.
I'd rather I delayed thoughtful discussion for later. That's fine.
All right. I do want to get the librarians up here today, too. So, thank you very much. I believe we have Mark Renham and Elaine Keith. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe it'll just be me this afternoon.
Okay. So for the record, please.
For the record, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Mark Ranum. I'm the director of the Plum Creek Regional Library System in southwestern Minnesota. I'm also the regional public library representative on the for the legacy funds and was on the 10-year plan and 25-year strategic framework committee as well. Also for the record, I'd like to say that I can't follow a four-year-old reading a book. I'm a librarian by profession. I think I give in. That's it. I can't take it after that. We have a couple of handouts for you. The first one is the Library Strength in Minnesota brochure. And really, I'd just like to point out on the back, this is the map of the regional public library systems in the state. While over 90% of funding for library services in the state are provided by cities and counties, the state does provide infrastructure money that is carried through the regional public libraries to support activities such as delivery, infrastructure for telecommunications, automated library circulation systems. The Electronic Library for Minnesota is part of the state funding, and the resource sharing that happens within MinLink and Minitex as well. The state's 360 public libraries fall under one of these regional library systems, and the regional systems cooperate together to not only share materials but to make access seamless for people no matter where they are in the state. We also have a legacy handout for you that is titled Minnesota Library Legacy. And I'd like to talk just a bit about the kinds of work that libraries have done with the legacy funding. First, I'd like to thank the committee from 2 years ago for entrusting libraries with these state funds. The library network of 360 libraries in the regional library systems provide a unique method for distributing legacy programs, services, and projects around the state. We have the strongest network, and in fact, in many cases, the local public library is the arts, culture, and history center in a local community. That's what we do. The regional libraries undertook a strategic planning process individually and collectively. We wanted to make sure that our community members and our legacy partners were aware of what we wanted to do, but also we wanted to know from them how they wanted us to proceed. We established some effective administrative controls and transparent and comprehensive program tracking with the aid of the State Library Services Agency. The acting state librarian, Nancy Walton, is here today as well, and I would like to publicly thank her for her extremely strong efforts in this area to ensure that libraries were able to effectively track and compile the information, part of which you're receiving today. So what happened in libraries? in libraries, over 300,000 people came into contact with programs and activities related to Minnesota Library Legacy programs. These Minnesotans came into contact through 4,000 programs in libraries. By the way, the numbers on the front page are a little low because we established it just a few weeks ago, and turns out the numbers are higher. But we have over 4,000 programs in libraries, but also in community centers, schools, nursing care centers, historical sites. We were outside and inside. We were at bookmobile stops doing legacy programming in communities with no library. We had a really comprehensive drive to provide access for the people who were paying into this fund to the programs that they determined that they wanted to see. We also created over 1,000 partnerships and worked with community partners, large and small. Our largest partner was the Minnesota Historical Society, where we brought the Minnesota The Greatest Generation program, the History Day that's run through the public school system and through the Minnesota Historical Society, and intergenerational Share Your Story programs across the state as well. We also had lots of small partners, many of whom didn't bring money to the table. What they brought was talent and effort, and they brought their own audience in to help libraries share the legacy outcomes that the legislature wanted to see. I have a couple. If you turn into the brochure, you'll see that we've listed out about a dozen different highlights from across Minnesota of those 4,000 programs. And they cover arts, history, and cultural programs. You'll see things like the Bemidji Symphony Orchestra, which sent a subset of that orchestra around that region to provide performances in locations that have never had orchestra performances before, and included funding for one of our own Minnesotans to create and perform a unique and original work. You also see that in the statewide history partnership, the Greatest Generation History Day and Intergenerational Share Your Stories traveled throughout Minnesota, and we did literally hundreds of programs around the state in partnership with our history partners. And we also did some very unique things. You'll see there's one program on the Rapidan Dam that affected the culture of southwestern Minnesota and southern Minnesota, south central Minnesota, 100 years ago when that dam was created and provided power not only to the city of Mankato but then eventually changed farm life in southern Minnesota through providing rural electrification to farms, only 10% of whom had electricity in 1930, and when that dam expanded under the WPA, it changed the culture and the times that the farmers were living in and what they were available to draw from in terms of resources to provide food for the rest of the country. So we've got a number of different programs for you to look at. I'm sure that several of you may have been hearing from your local libraries and probably have seen some of the announcements about legacy programs coming out, and we anticipate that we can provide information about almost any particular kind of program at a moment's notice. Our tracking and administrative controls are tremendously detailed, and we have most of this information electronically, so we can provide it very quickly. And then on the back page, we have listed a few different websites with some information from a variety of different representative types of library programs. But then we have what my favorite section, different quotes from Minnesotans. There's one on the front page, of course, where the child who was missing his swimming lesson said, "This is better than swimming," when he got to hear the Irish musicians. But I really like the young child who said, after an accordion presentation, I think I want to learn how to play the accordion. And this was the first opportunity that child had seen or heard an accordion in action. It wasn't like the rest of us who's my mother and my grandfather played the accordion, and I heard it quite often. But for this kid, it was a brand new experience, and to see it fresh through that child's eyes was really amazing. And then we've got a 100-year-old resident at one of the senior arts programs that said, "This is one of the best things that has happened in my life," which I continue to think that perhaps the end of World War II and some other things might have been some of the best experiences in his life as well. But it's great to be able to bring that kind of programming out that touches people who would otherwise never get a chance to experience this. And just to close before I take questions, one of the things that I was thinking as I put those two together was that I sort of hope that in maybe 50 years I might be in a nursing home, and maybe a middle-aged man will come in with his accordion to play for me and say, you know, I learned about this because of legacy funding, and I went as a small child and learned how to play the accordion. And for me, that would be a tremendous circle that we could provide, and I would love to see that kind of activity and outcome happen for not only myself but for the rest of Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll take questions from the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Randleman. And first question, these various places that you gave funding, could we have a list of how much went to each?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. We can provide detailed information on each one of those programs, as well as site by site for some of the ones that were like the intergenerational programs, where we did it five different locations around the state in partnership with MHS. Okay. We have detailed funding for all of those projects.
Okay. For transparency, we'd like to know where the money went, and also on that the legacy website, we'd like that type of information as well,
right,
so that the public can easily access where the money is. And while I'm on the topic of full disclosure, a few people in here know that I might write a book every now and then. And, I have actually received requests for this summer to speak in libraries, basically the program here. And so, again, in full disclosure, this representative author does not take any money for going to these libraries. Would put me in a position I wouldn't like to be. So, just so. If anyone wonders and you hear that Representative Erdahl spoke in a library, he was not being paid, which might segue me into something else here. Questions? Comments? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Annam, along the lines of the Chair's question, was Meet the Author, where in my area out near Stillwater an author came to a library, was that part of that program, where if you could give me your take on it? It's my understanding someone got a rather large fee to come and speak at the library.
Mr. Rapp,
elaborate a little bit on that situation for me.
Mr. Chair, Representative McMurray, that's correct. There was an author named Neil Gaiman, a well-known author of not only teen materials but other types of materials, who came to Stillwater as part of a project that was put together with the local libraries out there called Club Book, which was a way to reinvent book clubs for folks in the metro area. Neil Gaiman was paid $45,000 for his appearance before about 500 people at the Stillwater High School, so it was a partnership with the school as well. That program was not only done, well, first of all, it was limited to 500 because that was the capacity of the seating area. Neil Gaiman often draws 1,500 or 2,000 people in. We just had that much space. However, we also had that program taped and archived by Minnesota Public Radio, as well as on the Club Book website through MELSA. Minnesota Public Radio broadcast that program twice with a total of about 70,000 listeners across the state who had access to it. In addition, the website at NPR has had thousands and thousands of downloads and hits on that particular presentation. And that presentation was a targeted presentation as part of an overall effort to reach out to people, particularly some of the people that libraries tend to miss. And young boys in particular, and young men in high school, Neil Gaiman speaks their language and speaks to them, and that was an effort to bring in not only that particular population, but also connect the library to that population during that program, and then follow up with programs. So this was, you can think about this as sort of a kickoff program that had lots of tails to it. It had an archive tail with people being able to access the program. It had a programmatic tail that allowed the Stillwater Library and other libraries to do follow-up programs and presentations. And it also, gave sort of this highlight to the year for that area, that part of the Twin Cities area, for their legacy funding program.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Representative McNamara.
And Mr. Ranum, did you or one I would ask, was this fee unusual? It looks like there were 7 authors, at least if I read it right here. Was this fee unusual among the 7?
Mr. Adam.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm not sure exactly what the fees were for the other authors, but I believe it was, I'm almost certain it was the highest, and it probably was an unusually high fee. Once again, part of the reason for the higher fee, in my mind at least, was the extension that this program gave off. Neil Gaiman keeps his fees high because he doesn't want to continually turn people down. He also does a number of free and sort of benefit-related kind of presentations during the year. For us, for libraries, and I think for the metro area libraries and for MELSA, who provided this author talk with the legacy funds, this was, once again, this is where we're trying to respond directly to community needs, trying to ensure that we provide some opportunities that otherwise would never be available for these folks. And I think that, you know, along the way, we learn something about this as we provide these kind of presentations. As I like to say, it was, you know, it was a significant amount of money. It wasn't like bringing Brett Favre in for a Sunday afternoon, which would have cost you $1 million, but it was, you know, a significant amount of money. We think, though, the tales were definitely worth it.
Mr. Ranum, I'm going to try and ask simple questions so I can get simple answers. Were you involved in the negotiations to bring Mr. Gaiman in?
Mr. Ranum.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, no, I was not involved in the negotiations for that.
Okay. Well, yes, you could
Representative
provide,
McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could provide to this committee who was involved in that, what those negotiations were. My understanding is that we may not have even asked him if he would come for a reduced rate, didn't ask him if he'd come for free. I don't think the people that voted for this amendment, including myself, envisioned us paying $45,000 for an author to come to a high school auditorium and talk about the book he wrote. And I don't know that we want to try and justify it here. I'd be more interested in learning how we can learn from this huge mistake and the wrong way to spend state money and not try and justify it, because it's not the right thing. And we need to know how the decision was reached and who made it, so we don't do this kind of stuff again. I don't want to see this on the ballot in the future to repeal this thing. And this is the kind of stuff that people don't want to see. So please look into it. Give us answers so we know it's not going to happen again. We need to know how much the other 6 were paid and how long. $45,000 for a night to speak to 500 people, that's $90 a pop for these people. It's not the right thing.
Mr. Adam.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'm not sure if that was a question. We can certainly give you all that information, and in fact, we can provide not only people to speak directly to you who did the negotiation, but also to any members of the committee or any other members who are concerned about it.
Well, Mr. Adam, let me just say that folks will be coming before us again if they expect money again. So they will be asking, making a request. And when that request is made, I would expect that before that time or as part of that presentation, the answers to Mr. Representative McNamara's questions will be provided.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We will provide full details and disclosure about whatever aspect that Representative McNamara or anybody else who has questions about that program would like to ask.
Well, provided, please, to me, and also as part of the presentation, I think, when the request is made of us. Because I do agree that $45,000 for one speaker is difficult, and maybe you can try to justify it, but if we have to try to justify this to voters, to defend the legacy funding, I think it's problematic. Other questions? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Erdahl and Mr. Ranum. I don't have a question. I just want to comment on Representative McNamara's comments. I just want to let you know personally that I find that fee utterly offensive. And I do not believe that this is what the people envisioned when they voted for it. And I say that because I don't think I'm alone. I don't think I'm the only legislator, and I don't think I'm alone amongst the public when people expect these funds that they are paying out of their own pockets, especially when they're in a special fund that's in a different fund that we can't use to solve our budget deficit. These are not the type of expenditures we expect to see, and it's personally offensive to me that a $45,000 fee would go to an author who didn't even request that. And so I'm just passing along my message, and I understand you're not part of the negotiation, but to whomever it should go to, please pass that message along.
I'm just wondering, $45,000, did that include his airfare, his expenses too? Or is that extra?
Mr. Chair, Neil Gaiman is a local author, so I don't believe there was any other expenses, but once again, we'll find that information out and provide that detail for you.
All right, thank you. Other questions? Well, that was easy, Mr. Random. Not very many questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Anything else come before us? We did the minutes. Well, King, this case is closed.